Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Andrew Smith, the author of Terre and Terroir, The Wine Growers of the Languedoc and Modern France, and the book was published by Manchester University Press in 2016. Hi there, Andrew.
Hi, Roxane. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Absolutely, of course.
Could you get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France?
Well, at the minute, I am a senior lecturer in contemporary history and politics down at the University of Chichester. And I've been working on France really ever since I was an undergraduate. When I started at university, I didn't really have a sense that France was the way I was going to go. I was really passionate about history, but I didn't really know, I didn't really have a focus in terms of area or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was largely to do with an aspiring teacher at university, as so many of these things are. Mm-hmm. A chap, Stephen Tyre, that I worked with, who his classes were wonderful. We studied Algeria. We looked at a whole host of different topics that really fascinated me about French history. And so I found myself kind of falling into it that way, really just through undergraduate study. And that was the way I kind of got into French history, which obviously carried on through postgraduate and then into the PhD as well. So,
And what brought you to the study of wine in particular?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was one of the interesting bits, because I've always been interested in wine. And I say that not just as a sort of passing everyone loves a drink type thing, but my dad was a wine merchant when I was growing up. And so I was aware of the world of wine. I saw him involved with wine, going to France. That always looked nice. And actually, one summer during high school, he asked what I was doing that summer. And, you know, the answer is the same as ever. Nothing much, just playing football and messing around. So actually, I did a course, a professional qualification in wine during that summer of school. I had to tell some fibs because I was 15 at the time. So under the drinking age, but so that kind of first of all, it gave me a taste for wine, which my budget probably still can't support, but it also then kind of drew me into working with wine. When I was at university, I had to do a bunch of jobs, number of jobs as well, and I worked in a couple of wine stores and then took on some work doing tutored tastings. I started working for an independent wine store, and actually up until the very end of undergraduate, that was the way I thought I was going to go in terms of careers, because it seemed to be the most promising. But I decided to stick at it and go into academia. And that was really how I came to this topic as well. Mm-hmm. Because when I was trying to think of a dissertation topic, it was actually Stephen Tyre I was talking to. And he suggested I start thinking about things I liked, French history, and what else could I combine it with? I said, well, you know, passionate about labour history, about wine. He said, well, where's the intersection? What's your favourite wine? And actually, my favourite wine has always been Fitou, which is, of course, a very famous Languedocian red, which I absolutely love. And so once I started looking into what the history of Fitou was and if there was any interesting stories around the area, very quickly I stumbled onto the group that I wrote my book about, who I think are phenomenally interesting.
It's funny because when I was reading the book, I felt this kind of topic envy, right? Thinking that wine drinking is often the opposite of work for me, or it works in the sure. opposite yep. direction. Yep. And I thought wine drinking is part of his job in some ways, or at least a familiarity with it. So in the introduction to the book, Andrew, you talk about this project as a political history of wine. And we know a lot about wine as a kind of national emblem of France and its associations with high culture and luxury. But what you're interested in this book is wine radicalism. True. And you use this word in the title and throughout the book, terror. So I guess I want to ask you about how you're using both the word terror and terroir.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's important, as you're saying, to think about what wine is. Wine can be a product which is very high-end, it's luxury, it's something which we associate with leisure, it's something which we talk about in terms of enjoyment. You know, we use poetic vocabulary to describe it. Mm-hmm. But it's also something that's very everyday. And actually for, you know, much of the period that I'm talking about in the book, for much of the 20th century, it's something which is just an everyday drink. It's not something that people wax lyrical over. And that's one of the things that really interests me. First of all, the type of wine that people actually drink, not the type of wine that people write poems about. The other thing is, part of me is more interested in the people that make the wine rather than just the people that drink it.
Right.
Because I think that's where we start to see these kind of, you know, very high concept ideas of, you know, when Roland Barthes talks about it as a totem drink. And mm-hmm. When we look at ideas of consumption, that's when we really find this kind of lyrical identity talk. And for me, I really wanted to see, well, fine, yeah, sure. But what about the people that make this stuff? Because they're not wealthy by and large. They're not, you know, very urbane. They're not people who are the sort of people that would engage in that sort of highfalutin lyrical language around wine. And so for me, the part that I wanted to look at was, as you said, this political context of wine, the way that we can actually understand it as being something which is a staple and not a star of the dinner table, mm-hmm. by looking at producers, not consumers, by understanding in that sense what it means. So that tries to take the balance between these two ideas, between, on the one hand, terroir, which is, as we know, it's this French concept, this kind of magical, romantic topic, which unites the grape, the vine, the soil, the sun, the grower, phases of the moon, if you want to go that far. Mm-hmm. I mean, all this stuff, it's sort of religious in a way, and it becomes this sort of untranslatable, this unrelatable, magical sense. And in many ways, it is a poetic, lyrical, magical thing, and it inspires. And I think that's quite important, because that kind of stuff can be political as well. It's about the kind of the gut reaction. It's about the things we feel. It's about, you know, we hear people talking about ideas of colonial common sense. Things like that kind of bridge the gap between what we articulate on an everyday basis and what we actually see mm-hmm. played out in front of us. So terroir is something, it's a rich, dense, knotted topic we can pick out. Now, of course, that flies in the face of something like terror. That flies in the face of political violence. The two could barely seem further apart. But actually, it's that sort of lyrical commitment to the idea, to the field, to the industry, which I think creates something of that potential for violence. I think it's important not to just look at it as something, the violence which we see and which I describe in relation to the Languedoc is not based on some huge idealism. It's not based on some sort of ideology of violence. Mm-hmm. It's an everyday, down-to-earth response to market fluctuations and real grinding poverty at times. When we look at something like wine growing in the Languedoc, I find it easier to frame it in the context of something like shipbuilding in Glasgow or Newcastle, or in the mm-hmm. US, something like car making in Detroit. It is something which just makes the region move. And so when there are huge fluctuations, dinner's not on the table. People go hungry. People, you know, really feel that downturn in a very personal, physical sense. And they're not, by and large, employees of some huge company. They can't go out on strike. And so suddenly they find themselves in mobilization, in direct action, a new method of actually making their voices heard. And so for me, that's the kind of the very broad bridge between those two seemingly, you know, opposite terms in terra and terroir. One sort of romantic mythology, the other sort of like horrific and actually quite gutsy response to real poverty.
Right. Can we back up a little bit, Andrew? And I mean, I know that the Languedoc has a really long and rich history and that you can't easily summarize it, but just for listeners who might not be as familiar with the region itself, what some of the key points in its history might be that we would want to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're talking about the very south of France. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the big wine growing centres, which around the cities and towns that will be famous to people's ears, like Montpellier, Béziers, Carcassonne. Mm-hmm. Further south, like Perpignan. We're talking just about where France comes down to meet Spain. And then moves around, kind of bordered by Marseille and the other side as it follows it around the coast. So we're talking about this, an area in the south of France which is coastal, but then has sweeping plains and then larger mountains towards the rear as well. So we get a sense in the Languedoc that we have a divide between mountains and coastal plains, and that's played out in the quality of wine as well. But the departments are usually the ones we talk about are Aude, Hérault, and Gard. Sometimes we might go down to the Pyrénées Orientales as well to draw them in terms of their winemaking. But they tend to be the focus of this region and its wine. Previously, its historic identity is that it's sort of brought into the purview of the French state during the Albigensian Crusade. It's up to that point, it's part of the land of the Counts of Toulouse.
Mm.
And following the Albigensian Crusade, of course, Simon de Montfort and the Crusade south to rid the south of heresy, to rid it of the Cathar heresy, means that the lands of the Counts of Toulouse fall forfeit and are seized by northern barons, which sees them then brought into the purview of the French state. And that actually marks the idea of regional identity quite strongly, I think. Mm. This idea of difference, this idea which much later they come to call colonization. But also it characterizes the attitude and the response to that identity thereafter. So in terms of industry, it is up until the early 19th century, there is a good linen trade and cloth trade in the Languedoc, which starts to fall away as other centres develop a much stronger, more industrial capacity to produce. What we then see is, along with the growth of railways, the Languedoc comes to rely on its greatest asset, which is sunshine and lots thereof. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great place to grow wine, it's a great place to grow vines because they're very productive in the sun. And so, yeah, the Languedoc starts to kind of take up this role as the sort of vineyard of France because it produces this basic staple wine and it produces lots of it. And as railways become increasingly important in the kind of 1860s, kind of early 1840s onwards, that really pushes out the produce of the Languedoc all the way up to the north of France and beyond. It becomes the place that wine is produced.
Right. So, Andrew, not knowing a great deal about wine history myself, I'm just wondering, you know, if you could say a little bit about who you're speaking to, who the book is addressed to. I mean, we already talked about the idea that this is a kind of political and social history of wine rather than an emphasis on that luxury culture and consumption, and that you're interested in producers. So there's that. Who are you in conversation or maybe even in debate with in this book with respect to wine history? And then, if this is the case, the broader kind of post-45 history of France. Do you see the book as a contribution along those lines?
Yeah, I certainly hope it is. Some fantastic work on wine. People like Colleen Guy have done some amazing work on champagne, talking about ideas of consumption and how that fits into projections of national identity. Marion de Mossier, likewise, has done some really phenomenal work, which talks about the symbolism of wine, how its production has changed, and how that really has been important in shaping French identity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fantastic book, and now an older book, by a chap called Charles Warner, called The Wine Growers of France and the State, I believe. Which is really good, but tantalizingly, as far as the Languedoc is concerned, ends in 76, which is a bit of a totem year for for them. So those books, I think, are really interesting in terms of what I'm speaking to in terms of wine. Of course, there is a very strong French heritage of very strong French language historiography around wine as well. People based in the South who are producing wonderful, wonderful work talking about the same types of episodes that I'm describing. Rémy Pêche and Jean Sagnès have talked a lot about 1907, about the Sagnès wrote a very famous book about the Midi Rouge, and Geneviève Javignaux-Fontaine has done a number of really big, great surveys of the period. But what I've tried to do differently, what I've tried to add to that, is really to try and look at it from a sort of different perspective. I've tried to take it away from the first couple of people I mentioned by looking at producers rather than consumers.
Right.
I've tried to take it away from the work of some of the French scholars I've mentioned by trying to kind of internationalise what I'm looking at as well, to look at the sort of global connections and try and understand it in a grander framework, not really just about the history of the wine industry, which is a term we use in English, which is wholly unacceptable in French. But
I like that moment in the introduction to the book where you talk about using it, I think, in an interview and having someone frown at you about it.
Oh my God, yeah. It was one of these things where people just looked at me as if I was had two heads or something. You know, wine's not an industrial beverage. It's an I didn't mean. Sheer panic, as my undergraduate French was not particularly holding up at that moment. The other one was when I asked if people approved of direct action, but actually they took it to mean the terrorist group from the 1980s. And again, I got myself into a pickle trying to walk backwards from that and say, I'm not crazy. But yeah, so I've been trying to kind of do some of these things to look at it a bit differently, try and contextualize it in a bigger way.
Let's talk a little bit, Andrew, about who the book is focused on. I mean, producers, yes, but you really follow this thread of this central organization that I'm going to call it the CAV. I don't know if that's what people call it. And then also, you know, the how in terms of your source material. You mentioned that you did some interviews. I know you also look at the regional press. If you could just say a little bit more about who and what you're using to access the story that you're telling in this book.
So one of the things when I started looking at the topic was I ran up against what anyone who studies, well, labor history in general, but specifically French labor history, which is the alphabet soup of syndical organizations and trade unions, and trying to get your head around those struggles and those internecine conflicts and, you know, that kind of stuff is really, really tough. So there's a chapter in the book which looks at the post-war history of those winemakers' representative groups, at the trade unions, at the groups which really try and negotiate around, you know, what happens to wine growers and how they actually have a voice in government. But the group that I'm really massively interested in is, again, the group you referred to there, the CRAV, the Comité Régional d'Action Viticole, the Regional Wine Action Committee. Now, and they're also sometimes just called the Comité d'Action Viticole, which is the Wine Action Committee as well.
Right.
They come into existence in 61, after a period of wrangling between all these different trade unions that tried to outflank each other on the left.
Right.
And they kind of cut this knot and really do so by just simplifying the message and by talking about direct action, by talking about their opposition to imports, by just saying, look, let's not worry about broader issues of, you know, politicking and all the rest of it. Let's just get out there and on the streets. Now, the reason I find them so interesting is these guys, by and large, the first generation of these wine commandos, as they get called, come back from doing their 30 mois in Algeria. They've done their military service. They've been, they've tried to serve the state in a, you know, a horrible bloody war, which affects many people. They come back home, broadly young men, to villages, towns, which are just as poor as they were when they left, just as much on the periphery of the French state as when they left. And suddenly, a number of them, and particularly one guy, André Caz, starts to draw some links and draw some kind of direct experience from the methods, if not the ideology or anything like that, of the people they'd fought in Algeria. Mm. And actually, it's really interesting. You see a lot of people talking in the 60s, in the early 60s, about using new methods they learned, cutting down telephone poles, you know, cutting down signposts on roads, you know, taking direct action in ways that actually will disrupt the state. Mm-hmm. And they literally say, you know, we're doing it comme les felaha, we're doing it just like we did against just like we saw people do in Algeria. People say, you know, it worked for them down there. Why won't it work for us here? And so that's really interesting. It's not, you know, that they support the FLN or it's not an anti-colonial struggle. I don't think you can write those kind of broader solidarities whatsoever.
Right.
But what it is a kind of like accretion of methods. They take this kind of core of sort of guerrilla methodology and really kind of grow it once it takes root in the Languedoc. Mm-hmm. So that for me was absolutely fascinating. So you get, I think, somebody like André Caz joins up with another guy, André Castéra. Castéra represents the sort of the old reliable wing of wine growers' representation. He is this wonderful figure. They call him the Christ of the Corbière. You know, he's got this like haggard face, this croaky voice, and this real kind of, he looks a bit like Samuel Beckett, I always think. Now, he's called the sort of professor, and André Caz, on the other hand, is this young, tumultuous guy who is, you know, a real kind of brawler, who's really seemed to be a bit of a kind of, you know, tribune. And actually, that partnership of the young, active hotheads alongside these older figures, these lyrical characters, these charismatic leaders, that's what produces this movement, this organization, the Comité Régional d'Action Viticole, as they from about 1961. So they spring into action. They start to really, you know, immediately start protesting. They start blockading roads. They start taking action in terms of bombing railway lines, cutting down telephone poles, cutting telegraph wires, starting fires. these kind of like low level sabotage attacks, which are designed to disrupt the state. Mm-hmm. Now, we see these things in different ways from the material that I used. In 61, the police, and this is one of the great things, you can use the renseignement général reports, the police reports that you can get in the departmental archives, look at what's happening in a region. And quite often they're taking the temperature of what's happening amongst wine growers. Mm-hmm. And specifically around 1961, they talk about a nouvelle vague chez les viticulteurs. So they're kind of, you know, they're sensitive to the fact that something's changing. And actually that's one of the most useful places that I found a lot of colour, were the police mm-hmm. reports on what's happening. Now, of course, there's difficulties in using that. They exaggerate it. They're trying to also look after themselves. So there's a lot of good support and a good coverage in the regional press as well. So there's a huge survey of regional press. There's a number of regional papers, many of whom are broadly sympathetic to the actions of these wine growers in the early periods, and are quite happy to print their communiques as they go. Now, fortunately, in the Archives départementales de l'Aude, you can find the archives of a group called the CGVM. It's the Confédération Générale des Vignerons Méridionaux, uh-huh. Which is a big umbrella wine growers trade union, which sort of is the long established one which gives birth to the CRAV. The CRAV draws on the accrued capital of the CGVM mm-hmm. When it actually is talking about its story. So their archives are in the departmental archives. Their phones are in the departmental archives. So we're able to access police records. We've got a lot of regional press. We've got records from the wine growers themselves.
Right.
There's a really great book which is written by a few of the wine growers, which gives us such a wonderful, rich sense of who they want to be, who they're kind of putting themselves forward as. So that's really great as well. And it provides this wonderful touchstone where you kind of get a good insight into joining the dots in terms of some of the people and characters that you see mentioned elsewhere. So there's a lot of documentary evidence that I followed. Otherwise, as you say, perhaps the most romantic moment of my doctoral research was doing interviews, because when I was doing it, I was too young to rent a car. You have to be 25 to rent a car.
That's right.
Yeah, so I would get the bus out as far into the countryside as it ran, and constantly mystified bus drivers would say, are you really sure you want to get dropped off here? And I would just walk and walk and walk and walk for miles and miles and miles, and turn up at vineyards, knocking doors, asking people, just trying to speak to kind of ordinary people, speak to owners, workers. Always being careful not to introduce myself as English, because that always produces problems in France. But instead, as a young Scottish student wanting to access XYZ and to listen to them and to tell the story. And so, you know, I wore holes in the bottom of my shoes walking and talking to people. And that was absolutely wonderful. You knock on some of these doors, some people say, of course, come in. Wonderful. You chat and you get these great things. Other times you speak to people and they say, no, go away, get lost.
Right.
But actually, some of the best material that I found was talking to people and just asking their opinion, and you get these wonderfully lyrical moments. Mm-hmm. There was a guy I spoke to just outside Perpignan, just outside, a good walk outside Perpignan, I should say. And he sat there across this huge desk smoking cigars, because of course. And I asked him, one of the questions I was asking people was about globalization. And he sat back and he said, mondialisation, c'est une force. And he said, it's a force like Hitler, like Charlemagne, and like them, it will pass. And it's just, wow, wonderful, amazing, you know, wow. Scribbling this stuff down. I'm not sure quite if I'm with them in terms of the logic of that quote or whatever, but in terms of colour, in terms of the material you want to gather from interviewees, that's right up there.
I'm just wondering, Andrew, I mean, a lot of the activity that you're charting in the book is illegal. So I'm just wondering if that played a role in your conversations with people, whether that posed a challenge in terms of the oral history work that you were doing in the interviews.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I always made clear to people was that I wasn't interested in naming them in terms of attributing actions to them or anything like that. I wasn't there to sort of settle accounts in that way. I said to them as well, there are a couple of people that are anonymous that when I cited their interviews.
Right.
And, you know, you did get a sense sometimes that people would tell you a story about a friend and you think, well, maybe you're not talking about your friend. And, you know, people talk about actions and give you quite a strong sense that they supported them, but then we try and back off a little bit and say, well, you know, no, maybe not like the worst of the things they did I don't support. So right. I think there's a lot of movement and flexibility around that. I did start to kind of like break the crust of it a little bit. I got like an anonymous message at one point which said, parlez du crevé dangereux, ... and that was one of the things I was going to call my thesis, because I thought it was amazing, this sort of like slight ambiguous threat when they said, you know, talking about this group is dangerous.
Right.
And I think in a sense it could be, but I was so obviously not a policeman in my shambling, disheveled state with my terribly accented French, no car or anything, you know, that they looked at me, I think, just as a sort of charity case more than anything. But the best thing is you sit down with a lot of these guys and you ask them, I mean, many of these people, when you speak to them, if they are independent wine growers, they're small business owners. So you're asking them about their grumbles with the local kind of regional council. You're asking them about their grumbles with government. Sure. So at the end of the day, you struggle to stop them talking, is the by and large of it. So, you know, I did feel like I sort of started to brush up against that idea of maybe the dangerous side of it, just a smidgen. But I hope that I always conducted myself in an open enough way that, you know, really I wasn't ever trying to get to the bottom of things or name people in that way. And plus, I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily sympathetic to them, but I'm certainly not unsympathetic. I think that's one of the things I try to get across in the book. I don't really set out to condemn these guys. Some people in France, when they saw the title saying terror, they were really quite sniffy about the fact of saying, well, oh, what are you calling these guys? Why are you saying that? And I'm saying it because it's a title and it's a snazzy title and I like it. But it's I think it helps to understand the pattern of movement, the pattern of mobilization. And I think actually when you look at the reasons that they do these things, they're not... The worst violence is not justified, but I think the anger is justified. The violence is misguided. There's a sort of passionate violence which really spills over and sets their cause back a lot. But that doesn't make the things they're angry about wrong. That doesn't make the things they're kind of passionate about wrong. And I think that's one of the things I really tried to get across. Not a sympathetic eye on their actions, but a sympathetic eye on the things which produce their actions and on their identity and on their claims and their voices.
Well, and I think there is certainly a political effect to using the word terror at this moment in time in an expansive way, right? And given that it certainly has a quality of having been reduced in contemporary France and elsewhere to mean very specific activity by very specific groups at a really deep association with Islam in contemporary France. Like, so people use the term in a really reductionist way. So I think your use of the term is actually to remind us that there's a range of types of political violence and direct action. And I think it's important to use the word terror, or can be, in some ways.
Absolutely.
So the book is focused on the post-45 period, but mm-hmm. there is a prehistory here. And especially what looms especially large is this revolt, this moment in 1907. So the first chapter of the book really focuses on the memory of this turning point in the region with respect to wine growers. So can you tell us what happened in 1907 and why is it so important?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think in terms of our potted history before, we got to mass production and railways. And of course, the thing that comes next after that is phylloxera.
Right.
Phylloxera vestatrix, which is a tiny louse that eats the rootstock of vines. And in particular, and this is the kind of the geekier bit, I suppose, but it eats the vine stock of Vitis vinifera, which we call the noble vine. Now, the reason for that is because the phylloxera louse, the phylloxera vestatrix louse, is from North America. So it's imported into France by growers who are looking for a way to try and sort of increase profits. And so they end up, you know, bringing it across. And of course, it's used to eating the Vitis lambrusca vines, not eating the Vitis lambrusca vines, which have developed a resistance. But when they get to Europe, the vinifera vines have no resistance whatsoever. So there's devastation right across Europe, but especially in southern France, where, as we said, that's already a huge area of concentration.
Sure.
Eventually, the solution is to graft the vinifera vines onto lambrusca rootstock. So once that solution comes in, there is an attempt to replant, and there's a huge overheating of the economy in the south. People return to that sort of path dependency in a huge way. It worked before this disaster, and it will work now.
Hmm.
That's the real problem. This hugely overheating market clashes with developing practices such as sugaring or chaptalization, which allow lower degree wines to sort of add a bit of sugar during fermentation and then kind of up the alcohol contents to make them more appealing. Mm. And that's one of the big factors which causes the downturn in 1907, one of the big focuses of the protests. Now, the protests in 1907 start really after a series of mobilizations. There's a sort of precursor to 1907 in 1905, when you get all the kind of wine growers unions come together, but just don't quite get together. They can't quite bridge the gap between producer and proprietor. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing breaks up. But in 1907, that doesn't happen because really we get this one simple message. And a simple message articulated by a chap called Marcelin Albert. He starts a sort of a committee in Argelier. There's a government inquiry into what's happening with the wine in the south and why things are so bad. And they meet this government inspector and kind of start this protest. And so around this group in Argelier, around Marcelin Albert, you get this crystallization of a simple message that it's fraud which is the enemy and that the Languedoc is suffering. Albert's a simple guy, he's a cafe owner, he's a sort of petty bourgeois guy, he's not radical, he's not a revolutionary, he's none of these things, but he suddenly becomes the figurehead of this growing revolt, because where 1905 failed, 1907 succeeds because it's able to actually say, look, this isn't about politics, this isn't about proprietors and, you know, producers, this is actually about people struggling against fraud. This is about things being brought in and done to us from elsewhere. Mm. So they really are able to mobilize that rhetoric. And what happens is really over the series of Sunday protests, it builds and builds and builds until you get to this like height of about 600,000 people on the streets of Montpellier. This is a huge wave of protests. Wow. After this, you start to get a lot of violence involved as well. And the government under Clemenceau responds in a very heavy-handed way. There are troops in the street who fire indiscriminately at protesters. They kill protesters. A young woman called Cécile Burel is 21, is shot down in the street. And tragedies like that really kind of encourage more and more violence. You then get a theatre in Narbonne is torched. You get, you know, a huge amount of real anger and passionate anger comes to the fore. Mm-hmm. Notably as well, we also see the defection of a unit of the army, the 17th, who defect to the side of the protesters. So this seems huge, you know. They're drawn from the local region. They're not going to fire on their fathers, brothers, mothers, wives who are standing in protest. So they really kind of join the protesters, and it's seen as a momentous moment. One of the other things which becomes unacceptable, and it depends on the story you can you want to tell, but the government either reacts to all of this violence and the kind of threat of revolt and the telegram wires being cut and all this kind of stuff, or there's also the idea that a tax strike takes hold as well, and it really starts to kind of starve the government of any kind of income. So you combine this kind of really violent and visible protest, but also tax strikes as well, which produces huge kind of huge panic in government. So yeah, it's really the high point. It's the high watermark.
You refer to this moment, Andrew, as, and I'm quoting you here, the founding myth of viticultural radicalism in the Languedoc. And, you know, in this first chapter of the book, you are looking at the kind of interest in this moment in the immediate post-war period, or how this moment is remembered after 1907. And so I'm just curious about, I mean, you've clearly outlined why it's so significant and why people would want to remember it or consider it a founding myth. But how does the interest in 1907 converge or connect to what is in the beginning of the story of the book in the post 45 period, a region that is also recovering from the Vichy period?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think it's because the mythology is such a becomes such a good story. The idea that, you know, the region was able to assert itself, was able to kind of to drive change. It becomes a kind of radical past, which they're able to mobilize this militant past in service of contemporary political aims. So during that period of rebuilding, once again, you've got externally driven pressure to change. You've also got the emergence of the kind of deputy du vin, the wine deputy figure around people like Raoul Bayou in the kind of 50s and whatnot. But they're able to draw on a personal constituency of saying, actually, I'm here to represent the wine growers. And that becomes a really important focus of the Fourth Republic as well. So that is something which is important. Naturally, you get many of those people then pose with veterans of 1907 and veterans from the 17th. And so I think I talk about in the book, there's you know, those very famous photos where they pick out some of these veterans. There's also the Communist Party produces a film about the strikes in Renault, the immediate post-war period, and they actually start to talk about 1907 in the same way. And they raise it in the assembly, and it's actually, you know, people are worried about the radical potential for talking about defecting army regiments, for talking about people, you know, taking to the streets in huge numbers, and also the possibility of the communists taking ownership of something like this.
Right. The second chapter of the book, Andrew, is really focused on these themes and issues of post-war recovery, reconstruction, you know, rationalization, and the resistance to rationalization. And you're talking about, you brought this up a little bit earlier, this idea of political representation and representation of the interests of these wine growers in this period. So could you just give us, in broad strokes, what this period, 1944 to 1960, what's so central about this, and how the CRAV, well, it's created in this period, and what are the other organizations, what are some of the characteristics of the other organizations vying for position in this moment?
Sure, yeah. I mean, this is the kind of the alphabet soup period that I mentioned earlier on. So there's a number of different groups. One of the key ones is the Comité Marcelin Albert, which has a direct link again to 1907. I talk about the Défense movement, the Défense du Vin movement, which is really this body of kind of protectionist kind of issues around wine. So they're the kind of the archivists for the Défense movement. Other groups you get are like the Ligue des Petits et Moyens Producteurs, the League of Small and Medium Producers, which harks back to the 1930s as well. So many of these groups are kind of looking backwards. They're talking about the ability to really hark back to a different age, to an era of kind of more important mobilization. A number of these groups, another one to name is the Comité de Salut Viticole. Without getting into too much detail around the kind of syndical shuffling, because nobody wants to hear that. They basically keep trying to outflank each other on the left.
Sure.
They keep trying to get more and more extreme. They keep trying to say that other people aren't quite doing this right. And they're constantly kind of criticizing each other and fighting between each other. So in a way, you get the idea of small independent growers pitted against cooperatives and people who just kind of, you know, work in the fields pitted against those who actually produce. And it's a series of kind of internal struggles, which actually mirrors the period before 1907 as well, when you get all this kind of factionalism and internecine struggles as well. So that's where we get to during that period. Attempts to revive, attempts to mobilize, attempts to counter the great sales crises. Right. But ultimately, amongst those unions, it really is a sort of fighting amongst themselves.
We've already talked, Andrew, about the creation of CRAV and, you know, its evolution. And I'm just thinking that, you know, we could kind of move ahead to thinking about the late 1960s and then this other big moment that you talk about in the book. If 1907 is key and then the creation of CRAV in 61 is key, then 1976, the gunfight, as it's referred to. I need to ask you to tell that story in as brief a way as you can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, 1976 is the, at one point, it's the most outrageous thing that the CRAV get involved in. It's the, you know, 1907 is the high point, and then 1976 in many ways is the low point. It's a real tragedy. 1976 is the culmination of a huge period of what we call kind of almost open warfare with the police, cat and mouse struggles with the police, fighting with the CRS. Constant mobilization in cities and towns across the Languedoc and constant attacks, small attacks, which, you know, build up into a greater sense of unrest. And what eventually happens is that the CRS are accused of provocation, the wine growers are accused of provocation, and they start carrying guns. You know, we're talking about southern peasants, effectively. They self-describe as peasants rather than farmers. They carry hunting rifles. And so the fact that they start carrying hunting rifles is seen as a way of sort of protecting themselves against the provocations of the CRS, but it's also a fresh provocation as well, because we know the CRS are armed, we know they have tear gas, we know they have batons and all the rest of it. And what happens is in 1976, we get this moment on the 4th of March where there is a confrontation between wine growers and police. And really, they come to a head at a bridge at a place called Montredon. Now, it's one of these things. Nobody knows who shot first.
Right.
It's not possible to know who shot first. But what follows is a gunfight. And a huge number of people get shot and wounded, but two people die, one on each side of the conflict. So a wine grower is killed, and also a CRS officer is killed. Now this is huge, because I mean, up to this point, the craft, they mobilise, they protest, they bomb things, they start fires. This is, you know, it's property destruction. It's striking out against symbols of the state. It's an right. attempt to kind of, you know, to amplify their voices. But they don't kill, they don't murder, and this really changes and hardens the attitude of a lot of people, because. Because spilt blood does that, because, you know, killing people does that, because this is horrible. There's nothing that really defends this type of violence. Admittedly, the forces of order are not without fault in terms of the kind of aggressive way in which they continue to try and take the fight to the Krav. But at the same time, both sides come out badly. That stain of spilt blood is very difficult to wash off.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, Andrew, about... I mean, obviously there's the regional and then, you know, local motivations and evolution of the organization and these other organizations. But I'm just wondering, you know, here we're talking about this period from the early 1960s to the mid 1970s. So connections to, you know, a kind of global 68, well, and a specifically French 68 era. But then also as we move into the early 1970s, other types of regionalism that include violent activity, and then even, you know, throughout Europe and elsewhere, other types of movements that get labeled and understood as terrorists. And I'm just wondering if the Krav have a sense of themselves in relationship to workers and students in 68, yeah. or I don't know, the Red Army faction or whatever. Yeah. You know, is there that kind of broader referencing to other movements?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are attempts to draw much broader solidarities in the most immediate sense with the Occitan movement. Right. Of course, the kind of minority nationalism of the Longinoc itself. And that's really important. And that kicks off at really about the same time as the Krav. And that's one of the reasons that it really coincides. You know, from about like 62, you get a series of southern sociologists start to re-engage with the political potential of Occitanism, more than the sort of literary Occitanism of the Felibrige, the poetry, etc., but actually as something which is a sort of a political identity, a people's identity, as well as a poet's identity. And there's the formation of a committee, an Occitan committee for study and action, which starts to kind of become more and more radical. And actually, there's a sort of confluence, really, of causes. It's difficult at times to talk about an ideology that the Krav follows, except for this one of 1907, because it's very diffuse, because it doesn't have like a, you know, they don't have membership cards, they don't draw up tables, they allow a sort of degree of, a huge degree of flexibility for members, and then try and kind of apologise afterwards, if you see what I mean. But there are a number of people who kind of cross over with the Occitan movement and who engage with the Occitan movement. And we see kind of the Occitan cross starting to be born at the head of wine growers' protests. We start to see a lot more use of Occitan in radical wine growers' newspapers. So that's another thing I should have said I use in terms of sources. And so there's a huge amount of crossover and confluence. And one of the things I mention in the book is we see one of the chaps, Jean Vialad, talks about the fact that... around about 76, they get a visit from some of Colonel Gaddafi's representatives who sort of just try and sound them out to say, you know, hey, you guys look like radical revolutionaries who are fighting the state. Would you like help smashing the state? And one of the things they have to explain to them is actually, well, no, we're wine growers who remain Republican. We are actually interested in representing our interests and not in that. So there are definitely moments where you see these convergences with that broader kind of idea of international violence and solidarities with international violence.
Right.
With 68, the difference is sometimes the disconnect between cities and towns. So there are, one of the chaps, André Caz, does write an open letter to the students in which he sort of says, we need more support from you before we start to support your cause. And there is actually some movement around that. But 67 remains more important for the Krav than 68 because there is a sort of a huge market downturn, there are huge mobilizations. And one of the things that happens is in the elections that 68 triggers, André Castéra, the guy I talked about before, the Christ of the Corbière, he tries to stand against the Socialist Party and ends up losing. And it's a big defeat for the Krav. So actually, 68 itself isn't really that great for them.
Just a few of the stories that you've just told and then some of the things you said earlier make me, you know, want to not forget to ask you about the gendered aspect of all of this, the very dude-centric history. That's not
absolutely
your fault, but no. That, I mean, the way in which this story is, I mean, even just the Christ of the Corbière and these figures. And yeah, you do talk about the role that women play in this movement, but it is a pretty male movement. So could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was one of the things I found really interesting when I'm looking at it, because I didn't want to just write a history in which women were absent and that was uncommented upon, because it strikes me as unusual. Because when you look at some of the most famous images of 1907, for example, there are women front and center in those protests, carrying placards, filling the lines of protests. Like, they are involved and active in this defense of the region. Mm-hmm. But what you start to see, especially with the Krav and this idea of direct action, is this kind of idea of the wine commando start to come out.
Right.
And there's far, far less room for women to play a part in that, largely because of the sort of attitude of the region. I've written an article elsewhere about rugby, wine and socialism, which really defines this sort of holy trinity of southern masculinity. It's what tends to actually make somebody down south like a good guy, is they got to be all these three things together. And it's kind of interesting to see where that kind of excludes women, because it creates this hyper masculine situation. It creates this cult of action, which is really about kind of like people meeting around cafe tables and planning things and then pulling on some balaclavas and just doing it in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. So that's a space in which it's actually quite difficult for women to enter because of the homosocial element of that.
Sure.
But in terms of spokespeople as well, that's another point. There are some female spokespeople, in particular there's a woman called Madame Gély, but it's interesting to see, especially because one of the things is, you notice I just said Madame Gély, I'm not saying that out of some sort of odd chasteness. It's just simply because I've been unable to find out her first name anywhere.
Wow.
Everywhere I look, I can't find the woman's first name, because everyone calls her Madame Gély. She doesn't ever address herself by her first name. Nobody talks about her as a sort of person. She's talked about as the wife of a wine grower. All of the interventions she makes talk about the hearth, talk about home economy, talk about the impact of this and the need for women to mobilize alongside it. So actually, even when we do see women enter into this space, even when we do see prominent women spokespeople, what we end up with is really a reinforcement of the status quo and a reinforcement of quite kind of staid and kind of socially conservative roles. So this isn't a sort of like campaign for like ultra progressive, you know, like new alternatives. And I think that's something we can definitely say the Krav aren't, mm-hmm. Is a sort of massively progressive group in that instance. And that's one of the reasons we see them kind of having these odd alliances with different groups, because their politics aren't always hugely progressive. Their politics aren't always really positive. Sometimes these are quite kind of earthy responses, I think you might say.
You go on in the book, Andrew, to talk about the period after this turning point of the gunfight in 1976 and some of the big issues that you look at in this period from 76 to through the 90s and really right up to the present in some ways, are this transition to socialism in the early 80s and this era of modernization. And then also, you know, the role that these big forces play that are external to the region, the European Union in particular, you know, starting with the EEC and then moving on to European integration and globalization, however we want to define that term and think about that and the impact on the region. So could you talk a little bit about those big forces in that period from the mid, late 1970s through the early 90s?
Sure, yeah. I think it's a point of huge challenge, because the idea of fraud, the idea of imports, which motivates the wine growers since 1907, is really writ large as soon as you start to involve global markets. Mm. They have the Krav, the Défense movement, have extraordinarily low opinions of Italian wine, about which there's a huge scandal around the early 80s, but the mixing of ethanol with wine. They have extraordinarily poor opinions of Spanish wine, which they see as being kind of like often contaminated or polluted. They talk like they cast aspersions against whole nations. And when they talk about Italy, they talk about, you know, an Italian addiction to crime, etc. One of the silliest things they do after the kind of the horror of 76 is in 1984, they torch an absolutely huge Leclerc supermarket just outside Carcassonne. Now, they do that because they're protesting against the sale of foreign wine in French supermarkets. And this is one of the things we see them do quite a lot. They do it from like 60 onwards. They smash Algerian wine, they smash Spanish wine, they smash Italian wine. And they do it, first of all, by like hijacking tankers of wine, which might going to be bottled elsewhere, and spraying it and getting rid of it that way. They do it by boarding ships, which have tankers at places like Sète, and mixing motor oil with that wine. They do it by walking into supermarkets with baseball bats and smashing all the wine on the shelf. So when they burn this huge Leclerc supermarket, it's absolutely vast. And it's a huge crime. And what they lose in the fire is really their credibility, because when Leclerc is able to come down and talk to them, you know, it turns out that actually he is the largest seller amongst all his stores, of Audouin wine, and likewise that 0.1% of the wine sold in Leclerc stores at that time is from outside France. So they completely, you know, cut their nose off to spite their face by targeting this guy, who then boycotts Audouin wine for a significant period afterwards. And that really lends some space to people in the region who are more committed to the idea of development and the idea of changing the way that the Languedoc works, because this is really when you start to get that pressure from outside, that pressure from government, that pressure from Europe to produce less and produce better quality. That moment in 1984 is a really big window in which that it's a hinge, I think, on which the Languedoc turns. Of course, there are no longer just European competitors. The rise of the New World, of course, you can talk about the tasting in Paris in 76, the Californian wines and all the rest of it. All of this drives forward a market which is increasingly competitive as French people drinking ever less wine, and the Languedoc is being encouraged to produce ever less wine again. So these factors really converge, and not going to run through the statistics, they're in the book to see, but produce a period which is a kind of pinch point. So the craft lose a lot of credibility, they lose a lot of manpower, they lose a lot of voice, and that really seems to kind of dampen down the movement to something which is much, much less representative, much, much less a mobilisation of the base, and increasingly just a sort of lead-esque group railing against the void amidst all these kind of pressures towards globalisation, I think, that we see elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, Andrew, the role of the political left is significant throughout the story that you're telling in the book, and you know, and then you talk about this transition to socialism at the national level. I'm just wondering, though, how much this is a story that it works with our understanding of the history of the French left, whether or not you think of this as a history that is a contribution in some ways to a broader history of class or a history of capitalism.
Sure, yeah. I mean, so right from the start, the idea of socialism is right there. Even in 1905, the reason they can't go ahead is because, you know, supporters of Jules Guesde won't drive things forward. After 81, when you get the socialists in power, it really seems to change things, because it means that many of these wine deputies, many of these socialists who represent wine-growing constituencies, really can no longer talk about opposition. They can no longer talk about the centre, because suddenly they are the centre. And it kind of unpicks all this kind of, you know, traditional alliance, which has always been there between the kind of défense movement and its representatives. And that unpicking of that kind of specific type of Southern socialism, I think, is quite important. What that opens up is space for different types of radicalism. One of the things I don't do so much in the book, which I'm starting to do a bit more of now, and I've done a couple of papers looking at it, is, of course, if we're talking in an ultra-contemporary sense, this is the area where we see a huge development of support for the Front National, for example. Places like Béziers, the capital of the wine world, electing someone like Robert Ménard. And a lot of that's down to unemployment, a lot of that's down to negative attitudes towards immigration. And some of that, I think, is also to do with a sort of political kind of realignment which takes place towards the end of the 70s into the early 80s, which really takes place as the Front National is finding its feet. I think there are ways we can look at how some of the rhetoric of these groups fits into other things, how it fits, it can move from the far left to the far right. I think there's an interesting moment when in the early 60s and throughout the 60s, people talk about internal colonialism. But of course, that takes us down the road of the Cortes and the Zambes. It takes us down the road of sort of ideas of equivalence, of rejection of foreign aid. It can take us through Pujad and all of these things as well. And I think there is an element of that which is always at the heart of it. Many prominent Kravis throughout, they talk about, you know, Pujad and Pujadism as being petty fascism and all the rest of it. But then we end up in a period where 10, 15 years after that's been said, we're looking at the election of Front National mayors. So there is something, I think, to be said for how that realignment takes place, that broader shift, that disenchantment with an older vision of what the left is and a different vision of what the central state is. I think if anything, what we see throughout the period I talk about is the Logarok trying to accent development, accent change, and accent modernization, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I say in the conclusion is it's not about peasants into Frenchmen. It's more about peasants talking about the idea of Frenchness, talking about the idea of Languedocian identity, mm-hmm. talking about industry, talking about activity, and talking about class as well. And it's more of a negotiation and attempt to accent change at every point than really to reject it outright.
It was really interesting, given, you know, the recent election and reading. I mean, I feel like I've been reading endlessly about different versions of populism in the last year. And it was very interesting to read this book and to think about how this type of activism might now converge with certain types of political movements. Yeah, on the right, but also on the far left. So, it was kind of fascinating to read this book at this particular moment. Do you see a kind of connection for yourself as an author publishing this book now in relationship to contemporary French politics, either in the region or on a national level?
It makes me wonder. I think, you know, I come out of the conclusion really talking about the idea of alternatives and radical alternatives. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a history of mobilization within the crowd which speaks to those radical alternatives, to a desire not to kind of rot in the south or to rot in the periphery, but actually to make local communities viable, to talk about the fact that people should be able to live and work the land, to have sort of alternatives to industry, modern kind of machines and all the rest of it. I don't mean that in some Luddite sense, but in the sense that there are kind of different models of development which can be discussed. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's part of what I took from it. I think in some ways that's my sort of dreamy-eyed idealism that comes through that. Mm. I think you can look at it another way. And, you know, what are the Krav in some ways except a group who, you know, take direct action against the state, often unbidden by any higher authority, make, you know, grandiloquent demands to withdraw from Europe and stop imports and to ban foreign things, who try to kind of police their own communities in an active way that prevent people doing what they want, hyper-masculine, kind of exclusionary. Like, some of these things are contain the seeds of a really extremely negative reactionary point. So I find myself, I suppose as many people do at the minute, looking at, we talk about the contemporary elections, you could talk about someone like Hamon, who, you know, had wonderful ideas, but absolutely no platform, and was trounced and seems to have absolutely killed off potentially the party of the PS in France. But at the same time, you can look at the horror of the Front National and their kind of, you know, resilience, I think. Although they were resoundingly defeated in the election, there maintains a huge core vote, which, you know, presents that worrying sense. So for me, I suppose that tension, that uncertainty I have about what the Krav represent does speak to the contemporary political position in France, where I think a lot of people have that same worry, you know. There are real problems in terms of inequalities in France. There are real problems in terms of local communities and clearly division. And it depends whether those great radical alternatives are allowed to flourish or are able to flourish, or whether they continue to face a sort of continue to face the logic of the market, to put it one way, which I think drives the hand of people like the Front National and the worst elements of what I've been describing.
So, Andrew, there are many other questions I could ask you, but maybe you can just tell me what you're working on now that this book is done.
I kind of hinted at it there. I'm really interested in this idea of internal colonialism and how this develops. Of course, Todd Shepherd's wonderful book about inventing decolonization really inspired me to think about how some protest movements and radical movements in France, like the CRAV, like the Occitanistes, draw from the end of empire and start to kind of use some of that language, to use some of those types of methods and really build on those ideas. So I'm really interested by a broader study of how the end of empire sort of changes and inflects protest in France amongst groups which are perhaps not traditional, and how that maybe leads us towards understanding a better way to see where some of that transition between extreme right and extreme left happens in contemporary times.
Well, Andrew, I just want to thank you so much for joining me and for writing the book.
Thank you very much, Roxanne. Lovely to talk to you.